alcoholic.
I guess a good thing today, I know what I am. Took me a long time to get there. Maybe not as long as other people, but long enough for me. In the process, I destroyed your life as well as mine. When I got here, I thought I just had destroyed my life. That's how self-centered I was. I stayed here long enough, and you helped me to see the impact I had on other people and how a guy like me, untreated, is lethal and can burn out anybody in my path. Because I just don't care when I start drinking. I don't. I mean, I wish I did, but I don't. Yeah. My trouble started a long time ago, probably around 1966 or 1967. I was born in 1959. I'm 46 and a half years old. And the big trouble that started in my life is my mama told me there wasn't a Santa Claus. And I swear it went downhill from there, you know. I mean, there was nothing like Christmas growing up to that point. You know, the whole rest of the year, except for the other holidays, seemed boring to me. You know, I had that early problem of irritable, restless, and discontented. But it was boring, you know. And Christmas came along, and that 30 days before Christmas or 3 weeks, I mean, it made everything exciting. It took my mind out of me. I thought. But really was on me. And I was never completely happy after Christmas because I never completely got what I wanted. And the day my mama told me there was no Christmas, that was a bummer. All right, because that's one of the antidotes I had for boredom early on. And if I hadn't been too young and if I'd known better, I'd taken a drink. But I just wasn't there yet. At the same time, my mama told me there was no Easter Bunny. Can you imagine that? A double whammy? A guy like me? Yeah. If that bumper sticker had been around and if I had known about it, I'd have put it on my bike and it said, question authority. Yeah. Because I think after that, you know, I started to question authority. You can't tell me what to do. Look what you did to me. I've heard some other stuff around here, so I know what my problem is. My mama told me there was no Christmas. That's why I'm all screwed up. How's that? No Easter Bunny either. Thank God for Halloween. It's saved my bacon. What would you do with the rest of the year if there wasn't one more thing that you got stuff on? Well, Halloween led eventually to juvenile delinquency. When the candy wore out, you had something new. It's called eggs and ice pick. God, now you think, you know, what was I thinking and where was I at? Yeah. Wow. Well, I did get a couple years older. And by the time I was 13 years old, I guess that'd be 1972, I found a real antidote for boredom. It was called Boone's Farm Strawberry Wine. You know, and it tasted sweet, and the bottle was funny, and I liked it. And now I think today, they should have had a warning sign on the back. If you're 13 years old, and you drink a whole bottle, you might be a future member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because I had the lucky 13. And I got good and drunk. And I got in trouble. And I didn't get drunk the next day. Or the next week or probably even the next month. You know, that's when I was drinking periodically. In between that, since that was coming out of the late 60s, the early 70s, we started smoking that funny stuff. And what that led to was the new thing in my life. I found another thing. And I put a lot of time and energy into this one. When you think about all the time and energy I put into these things, no wonder I was screwed up. All right? But the next thing that I saw Because I always felt incomplete inside. Okay, I always felt like I wasn't enough. Don't know where that came from. At the same time, I felt like I was very special. I saw something in the local high school and in the middle school that really interested me. And that was being cool. And I thought, cool. Now that's a replacement for Christmas, the Easter Bunny, and Halloween. Cool. So I went home, and I started looking in the mirror. And see, when you're cool, you observe people. One thing about cool people, they don't talk a lot. Because if you talk a lot, it's not cool. You got to get the stare right. You look in the mirror. You get your face right. You put a lot of time and energy in it. You got to get the lingo down. Hey, man, what's going on today? You got any of that good stuff? Wow. You hear that? Man, that was cool. Ain't that hip? And I was walking around like that, and I thought, then you got to get the clothes that go with it. You know, you get the jeans that are faded. You have to wash them about 30 times, but after a while they start getting faded. You rip some holes in them. You put on some biker boots, the ones that got the ring on the side, the leather. So I had a pair of those. I put on a blue shirt with a red, white, and blue peace sign. You know, and I put on a faded jean jacket with a visine up front. I did a lot of looking. I did very little listening. Yeah. And I guess I was out to prove the system wrong, but I wasn't a part of it. They were doing us wrong because Nixon was around and everybody was against him and against authority, and they were trying to ruin our life, and I fell right in with them. So I'd walk around and I'd just sit there and I didn't go to school too much, a little here and there, because that wasn't cool. And I saw a bunch of these kids come out of the detention centers. You know, they had detention centers down there in Maryland, Southern Maryland. They come back, and they seemed cool to me. You know, I thought that was kind of cool. They went to detention for a month. Yeah, that's cool. Yeah, I smoke a little bit of this, and then the Orange Barrel and the Micro Dots and all that stuff came around. So one day I thought, you know, I'd grown up with the nickname AJ. Everybody said, hey, there's AJ, you know. AJ. Hey, AJ. I thought, AJ, that's not cool. I got to give me a cool name. Because you got to have a cool name to go along with being cool. So I said, one day I thought, in the midst of a flash of light, you know, induced by those things I was putting in me, I'm going to call myself Micro Dot. So I walked around and I said, hey, you know. Hey, Al, what's your name? I said, man, my name's Micro Dot. Try to give a look like this. And you put a lot of time and energy into that stuff. And so on the back of the jean jacket, I wrote Purple Haze. So everybody could look, you know, I needed some attention. And they looked. Some people thought it was cool, and some people thought it wasn't. By the time I was in 10th grade, I thought it was cool to drop out. So I dropped out. Because cool people dropped out. Why would I go to school? That's not what the cool people were doing. They were dropping out, going to the detention center. Well, my daddy didn't think that was very cool or anything about it. So he sent me off to a program. And prior to that program, somewhere within a year prior to that program, they sent me to the psychologist. Now, the psychologist had the same problem that every psychologist has that's trying to diagnose a guy like me. They're trying to diagnose me with an emotional problem. Because it looks just like an emotional problem. It feels like an emotional problem. It has all the symptoms of an emotional problem. Most of them aren't trained in what a spiritual problem is. So I looked like I had an emotional problem. I thought I had an emotional problem. So here's what they told me. They gave me a list. And they gave it to my parents. And they said that his problem is he suffers from low self-esteem. That's where his problems are. I thought it was Santa Claus not existing. But they said it was low self-esteem. Maybe that came from the Santa Claus incident. I'm not sure. They said that he suffered from a lack of self-confidence. That was one of his problems too. I thought, yeah, okay. They said he was not living up to or realizing his potential. Okay. And then they had me draw a picture of a person. I drew a picture, and after they looked at it, I don't know how long they studied it or what they studied, they said that he had a identity crisis because he suffered from a poor self-image. So I'm walking around with that, and I thought that was cool. You know? So I went and I bragged about it. Hey, man, I suffer from poor self-image. Hey, got another one? Well, my daddy sent me away, and he sent me to a very fine school. I stayed there for 26 months, and at the end of 26 months, I had self-esteem. That's what they said. I had self-confidence. That's what they said. They said now he's starting to realize and practice his potential. That's what it did. They said that he doesn't have a poor self-image anymore. Didn't know what it was to begin with, but I agree. Okay? Don't know what happened to the identity crisis, but maybe it was over. I'm not sure. I didn't hear much more about it. And as soon as I left that school, I had 2 drunk driving charges in 6 months. Because they had diagnosed me with an emotional illness that felt like one, looked like one, and had all the symptoms, but I suffered from a spiritual illness. Oh. I didn't know the difference until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I allowed you to diagnose me, unfettered by anybody else's diagnosis. Wow. And I found a place to fit in, where I was real goofy. And I found other goofy people just like me, felt the same thing I did, and did a lot of the same things I did. So I'm drunk. I turned 18 and a half. Well, I was 18, so it was legal age back then. And I'm drinking, and I'm cool, and I'm a hot shot, and I'm drinking Michelob. Okay? Michelob got me 3 drunk driving charges in a year and a half. Yeah, that's not bad. And I had all those things. I had my self-esteem. I had my self-confidence. You know, I had reversed my poor image, self-image. And I had realized and practiced my potential. I had 3 drunk driving charges. Because I'm an alcoholic. You know, I thought I was just having a party. Really. You know, I mean, what would life be without drinking? It was fun. You know? Unfortunately, my fun lasted 7 days a week. For some people, eventually the fun wore out. You know, the thing I tried to do with my drinking almost from the get-go was get good and drunk, or get good and stoned, or get good and drunk, and get good and drunk, and not have the consequences. I try to control the consequences. You know, the hangovers, the drunk driving charges, the relationship problems, the financial problems, the legal problems, the employment problems. I try to control them all, and I lost. I lost. So off I went to college, drunk. And in 5.5 years, five and a half years of college, I tried to major in, but they didn't have it on the list, drunk and failure. But they wouldn't give me a double major, all right? But I tried, all right? And when I left college, I was 1 credit short of a college degree. And they wouldn't give me drunk or failure, but they gave me something closer, close to it, because later on I did get it. They gave me a BS. That was pretty good, all right? And let me tell you, across the street in June from Frostburg University, they had graduation. All right? Everybody was coming. The mother, the father, grandkids, whoever. You know, grandma, granddad, anybody in the family was coming. Everybody was happy. I'm celebrating. I'm getting my diploma. I'm going to walk across the stage. And I moved into a vacant house across the street, with no floors, no windows, no doors, or no bathroom. And my landlord was an ex-biker named Pirate. And Pirate told me I could stay there for free. And that was my graduation ceremony from Frostburg University. My father didn't come. My mother didn't come. My brother didn't come. My aunt didn't come. My uncle didn't come. None of the family came. I'm sleeping on a mattress with no sheets, in a vacant house with no running water. That's where a guy ends up like me, because my life is based on self-will run riot, though I don't think so, because I think it's your fault. And I thought it was my parents' fault that they didn't give me a graduation present, some money, and they didn't get all this stuff sent to me, and I'm sitting in a vacant house. Well, after the three drunk driving charges, they had sent me to Alcoholics Anonymous at ASAP. And so what I did in the house, I said, I can't keep going this way. And I assumed that this was probably, to the best of my ability, 1982. Okay? And I sat in that house and just something struck me. And I said, I'm going to go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I did. And in a couple of weeks, I had had a sponsor, had a home group, and a whole bunch of people were picking me up, taking me to meetings because I didn't have a car, I didn't have a job. They helped me get food stamps. And eventually, a few months later, Pirate put in running water, so I had a bathroom. And we got some windows and we got a door. We got some floors. I got a bed, I got a mattress, and I got a job. And that was probably 9 months later. It took about 9 months for all that to happen. And when I got all those things, I walked out. I was going to a meeting almost every night of the week. I just quit. You know, I was trying to find some balance in my life. That elusive thing, balance, you know. This a little bit too much and extreme, a meeting every night. I need the job. You know, you need the triangle they teach in the treatment center, you know. You have to balance out your life. I know nothing about balance. I've never done it. As one man once said, "Is if I can't manage my life, what would make you think I can balance my life?" Balance for me is how many meetings can I cut out a week. That's what balance is for a guy like me, you know. I am so self-centered. So I got this job at Wendy's. And I'm always the architect of my own failure. And I thought after a couple of weeks, I'm going to end up being an owner of Wendy's. Yeah. They got me now on a hamburger stand, but just wait till they know who I am. I thought things like that. I told my dad that. He said, "Wendy's? What are you doing at Wendy's?" You know, with my one credit short college degree. And so one night I said, my old friend came back in my head, alcohol. You know, our book promises the insanity will return and I'll drink again. And it did. My old friend popped back in. Yeah. And I went out on a lie. See, I have a mind that lies to me constantly. That's not the problem. The problem is I believe it. And you can't tell me the difference. See, that's my problem. Second step calls that insanity. And that old friend came back and I sat in Georgetown, drove up there and I started drinking. And when that alcohol hit my head, I said, I'm never going to leave this again. This is absolutely wonderful. You know, I almost apologized, I think, to myself for not drinking for that long. Because I absolutely fell in love with it again that night. It would be short-lived, though. Because I rolled to a bottom pretty quick. Within 3 months, I lost that job, mainly because I had two incomes. I had one that they paid me every 2 weeks, and the other one came from the cash register out of the side window. And when they caught on to it, and I figured they had caught on to it, I just, one night, I counted the cash, I took some with me, and I left them a note, said, thank you for the employment. I walked out, and I got drunk. See, that's how I am. And for the next few months, I lived like a bum. I lived like a pig in a house. I didn't wash my clothes, nothing. I just sat. I just came home drunk into a room covered with clothes and dirty sheets and slept on top of it. And there was probably boxes of food everywhere around there and roaches, and that's how I lived. I worked down. I went down. I got a job at Joe's Pizza because I needed some money for rent. I needed some money for alcohol. And as soon as I bumped into Joe, he told me he was on his third drunk driving charge, but they had made a mistake because he had the flu. And I thought, oh, I've kind of heard that before. This, I knew I was home. Well, Joe and I drank every day all day long, and I can guarantee however long my employment was there, it seems like it was 3 months, but I really don't remember anymore. It was short-lived. I never learned how to make a pizza, all right? But I did learn how to put the thing on the keg and turn it. And that's where everybody that came into Joe's Pizza must have been an alcoholic because they drank all day long and didn't leave after they finished their pizza. So one day, I was sitting up in my dirty clothes asleep with my sheets and my roaches. And I thought, you know what? I almost have a college degree. I came from a pretty good family. I need to straighten up here. I need to do something with my life. This isn't the way a person like me should be living. I need to get sober. And my mind came up with a really good place to get sober, a place that would structure me into sobriety, and I just knew it. And I called up my mom, who was barely talking to me. My dad wouldn't talk to me at that time, neither would my brother. And I told my mom I was going to join the United States Navy. And I thought for sure that would be a place that I could stay sober. That's one of my grand plans again. So I went up to the Navy recruiter. I took their test. And he told me, Mr. Jacobson, you're in the top percentage of the Navy. I said, yes, sir. Of course, they asked me questions, if I remember. They say they changed the test. Was what was the first president? George Washington. You know, it was like, huh? I mean, I thought it was pretty easy. I didn't see anything they were asking that was rocket science or anything. And so he brushed my ego, and I thought that was great. We were having a talk, and he said, well, one thing I'd like to ask you, he says, you know, if you lie to us on any of these applications or to me, he says, you know, we got every service in the world investigating you. We've got our own special services. We've got the CIA, the FBI. He said, we can call them all in. We'll find everything that you've ever hidden. He said, would you like to tell me if there's anything? And I started rattling off. By then, I had 4 drunk driving charges. I'd been arrested 5 other times. I said, I'd had a problem with alcohol, but I'm sober in AA now. I lied. I told him that I didn't have a college degree, that I only had a GED. And he said, a GED. He said, young man, he says, you can't be an officer here. He said, that's not even as good as a high school diploma. You might have to start as a cook. A cook? Of course, I've been cooking in college all my life. I got nothing wrong with a cook. I still cook today. I like cooking. But I thought, a cook? Because I was ready to be an officer in the United States Navy. I'm not going to be a cook. So as usual, you know, I didn't sign the final form. So he called my mother. He said, where did he go? I don't call you back. You know, when I'm finished with you, you're over. I don't make calls back. You know, to tell you, to inform you why I'm not taking the job or why. I don't do those things. I'm gone. So I picked up another job. And I'm not going to get into that job other than it was where they sent me as a kid. And I went back to that school and they hired me. I think they were desperate for employment. And, you know, I did pretty good for a year there. I kind of cut back on the drinking, drank on the weekends some. I exhibited some control, which was an illusion. You know, it was another thing. I got a mind that lies to me, but that's not the problem. The problem is I believe it. And I believe that I was controlling my alcohol because I wasn't drinking every day anymore. I wasn't smoking that stuff anymore. I didn't put a lot of the other stuff in my system anymore. It was just pretty much alcohol. And I lasted there about 3 years, got a couple promotions. And on May 4th, 1987, 2 men sat down with me and they said they'd had enough. Because after the first year and the next 2 years, I became a nightly drinker again. The progression just kind of leaped and it hit me. And I was drinking till 4 a.m. in the morning and getting up at 6:30 to go to work. And there was just, you know, I couldn't shake off the hangovers. I couldn't do my job. I couldn't concentrate. I felt ill. I felt physically sick. I had a pounding in my head. I had felt like 100 needles in my stomach all the time. I had, you know, just heartburn galore and, you know, just aches and pains and organs and heads and noses and just vomiting and just, oh, God, you know. God, getting up in the morning was like terror. And it wasn't enjoyable. And it took me most of the day to recuperate till I got some food in my stomach. About 2 o'clock, I felt a little bit better, and I swore it off. And I'd say, I'm not going to go out tonight. I'm tired. I had it. I'm going to stay home tonight watching TV like the normal folks do. Go to work the next day. And you know what happened. You know what happened. I can tell you what happened. I didn't make the evening. I got drunk again. And so I sat in that office, and I didn't know it, that my bottom had taken place. And I can describe to you what my bottom was. It was complete and utter exhaustion. I was tired. I was worn out from the legal trouble, from the financial trouble, from the relationship trouble, from the physical hangovers. I was just plumb burned out. And they said, if you stay sober, we won't fire you, but we're putting you on probation. For, I don't know what they put me on, 30 days, 60 days, 90 days, I don't remember. I do remember them telling me to go home and thinking about it, and I thought about it that night, and I thought, you know what, I won't drink during the week, I'll get back to Saturday and Sunday night, and the week during the week I'll stay sober, but I haven't had a drink since May 5th, 1987. That didn't work. And so I came into an Alcoholics Anonymous that had been heavily influenced by the treatment center. Didn't know it. You know, I had no real upbringing other than the meetings I'd gone to in Frostburg for 9 months and the stuff. And that also had a lot of treatment center stuff in it. And everybody had an aftercare program. Everybody had a counselor. Everybody had just got out of a treatment center, had been in a treatment center, and everybody was trying to get 2 years of sobriety so they could be a treatment center counselor. And I swear that's mostly what was going on in the meetings in between. Don't drink, go to meetings, get a higher power, just say a prayer. And I picked up a little bit here and there and here and there in between all that stuff. And I didn't know that didn't belong in AA. I thought that was part of Alcoholics Anonymous. I had never known. And what I tell people is I stayed very sober in that stuff. Nowadays, you don't hear much of it because a lot of them closed down. But back then, boy, you did. Big time. And I kind of felt left out for a little while because I didn't have a treatment center. I didn't have a counselor. I didn't have an aftercare program. You know, when I was in Frostburg, my sponsor gave me a book. It was called The 12 Steps to Happiness. It's not conference approved. And it's probably not a book that I would read today. But I want to tell you what that book did for me. It removed all the fear of the steps. That's what it did for me. And when I came in the summer of 87, everybody was scared to take steps. Oh, don't do a 4-step. You might get drunk. Wait a year. You know, a lot of stuff and myths around the steps that didn't have any reality, any base in reality at all. You know? But a lot of that stuff was hanging around, and there's a lot of fear around the steps. And that book removed the fear. And I remember what somebody had said, I don't know who said in the meeting, he said, if you don't take get to the 9th step here and make your amends, he says, you won't stay sober. And I don't know why that stuck with me. I don't know who said it. So I went and I took the steps. Now, I took the steps off the wall. I had an off-the-wall program. I didn't have what we have today. We're a little bit more sophisticated today. We got a big book. We got a set of directions. AA as a whole is probably pretty present in the steps today. You know. I'm not going to say everybody walks in and does the steps and stuff, but as a whole fellowship, it's a lot more coherent than it was. And I stayed sober. And as I stayed sober and I went to meetings, and I went to a meeting every day, because I remember a guy up there in Maryland saying, you know, that meeting makers make it, and you need to go to as many meetings as you drank every week. I drank on a daily basis. They said, you need to do that for at least the first couple years, and I did do it for first couple of years. Went to a meeting every day. And work changed. All of a sudden, they made me the supervisor. And a couple years later, they made me a program director, and they put me in charge of a program. They brought me back and put me in charge of 2 programs. And all of a sudden, all these things started happening, you know, that were really good in my life. I made the amends to the family. You know, it took time. It wasn't just in one sitting. I had to act like I made amends after I made the amends, so it wasn't just an apology. You know, apology is saying I'm sorry, then not acting like it, you know. I overuse the word sorry in my family. An amend is being able to tell somebody where I went wrong. You know, ask them if there's anything that I can do. And then act like that. And I was acting like that in the family. I was acting like my amends. And they had a tremendous impact on my life that was very positive, both at work, you know, at home, you know, with the parents. You know, they didn't just straighten out overnight. But by the time I was 18 months, and some of that stuff happened past 18 months, I was sitting in these meetings. I really didn't have a sponsor. I was sponsoring myself, which is dangerous for a guy like me, to be back in charge of not running my decisions by anybody, just making them and going off the cuff, which I can have a tendency to do. And so what was very big then, because of the treatment center, was everybody was going to therapy, so I went to a therapist. I picked this guy in Longwood College. He was a doctor of psychology. His name was Dr. Stein, and I went over to his office. And, of course, first thing they asked me is, do you have insurance? That's the nice thing about AA. We're not on an insurance plan. So I said, of course I do. And I had to. So I went in there, and I explained to him what my predicament was and that I had troubles in personal relationships, stuff I'd heard in the meetings, and I guess I'd become victim to it because I was having some emotional struggles. I didn't know that was my alcoholism. You know, I thought it was something special. And I went to Dr. Stein, and I told him about my difficulties. And I told him I was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it was almost like he turned to stone. And I swear I remember a smile coming on his face. And he says, tell me about how long you've been in. I said, about 18 months. He said, tell me what you're doing. I told him how many meetings. I said, you know, I go to a meeting almost every night of the week. He said, well, you're pretty involved, aren't you? I said, yes, sir. He said, well, let me tell you from my professional opinion. People that aren't involved in AA that are alcoholics have a lot of emotional problems that they come to me with. He says, for the first time, other than an alcoholic, he started talking about a spiritual realm, much like Carl Jung was telling Roland Hazard, you know, that he had misdiagnosed his case, too, as an emotional problem when he really suffered from a spiritual problem. And in his own way, he described the thing, even though it was different. And he says, you're in good shape. He says, if I were you, I would keep doing the things that you're doing. He says, you're going to live on a higher level than most people because of your relationship with Alcoholics Anonymous. He said, I'm really happy that you're there. He says, you don't need my assistance. Whoa! Could you imagine if everybody did that today? Unfortunately, it's not trained. It looks like an emotional problem and carries all the symptoms of it. My problem is described all through the big book, but there's a place in there that really probably does a better job putting it together than in other places, and that's on page 52. Okay? And it asks the questions. Now listen to the symptoms as they relate to everything. Were you having problems with personal relationships? Yes. Did you have a feeling of uselessness? How'd you know? All my life. Yeah. Were you unhappy? Yeah. Okay. Because I never accept where I'm at. I always think there's a bigger bang. Okay. And it has a, were you full of fear? You know, you couldn't seem to be of real help to other people. And it just lays down these symptoms that look like it's everything else. But then it comes up with a solution that our problem is a power greater than ourselves. That's our solution. And the problem is that we haven't changed our point of view on it. Okay? In many different ways, the big book talks about being stuck in old ideas or point of views. And it says, here's the basic of your dilemma. It sits inside of you. You know? And I was like, wow. You know? And just about that time of Dr. Stein, I went down to Maryland into Florida. Oh, it said Maryland. I went to Florida, and I went to an AA conference, and I met this guy that I'd asked to be my sponsor. He was kind of an old, gruff guy. He reminded me of somebody I'd seen in Maryland. So I got his number, and I called him. And I said, Bob, would you be my sponsor? And he said, no. And I understand why today. he'd seen enough people playing games that he wasn't going to go through it with me because he didn't know me from nothing. But he said, no, you're welcome to call me all the time. So I'd call him. And one day he said, you know, Joe and Charlie, which were two guys that kind of brought the big book back to Alcoholics Anonymous, two folks from Arkansas. He said, they're down here in Albany, Georgia. I'd like you to come on down. You know, if that had been my dad, I'd have told him, no, I didn't have the money. I told him, I'll come on down. I didn't have the money. I was $28,000 in debt, a bad debt at that time. I didn't have a cent. Most of my income went to pay the bills. In fact, all of it did. There might have been $50 left. But I said, I'll come, and I did go. And by me going down there and being willing, he said he would sponsor me. Because I showed him I was willing to do something for another human being, besides what I always did, which is what I wanted to do. See, I'd ask you for help, and then put the help on my own conditions. No, I disagree with that. No, I didn't mean to get into that. I'm not doing that. See, I would ask you for help, and then I would put it on my own conditions. And that would destroy me every time. This is the first time in my life that I remember that I didn't put it on my own conditions. And Bob told me that he wanted me to take the steps again, so I took the steps again. This time I did it out of the big book. Was it perfect? No. But it was the willingness that changed my life. And that man changed my life because he introduced me to an AA beyond the treatment center that I saw in the fellowship. He introduced to me something I wasn't used to yet. Traditions. He had a simple answer for all of my complicated emotional stuff that went on in my head. You know, I'd call Bob up and I'd say, Bob, you know, I've been sitting around for a while thinking. I said, I don't know where I'm going in life. He'd say, well, that's real simple. Anything's better than where you came from. Nope. Whoa. I'd say, Bob, I said, I'm so angry. I've got so much anger in me all the time. I am just pissed off. I said, I don't even know where it came from. He said, it's always been there. You're just becoming aware of it now. Whoa. I thought it was something new. I'd say, Bob, I'm not very accepting. You know? When is this acceptance going to come to me? He said, what always precedes before acceptance is unacceptance first. You mean I was already on the way? I didn't know it. One time, I went out to Oklahoma and I gave a talk on the 12 steps. And Bob said, send me the tape. I sent him the tape. And for 3 weeks, he didn't give me any response. And of course, it drove me crazy because I wanted his approval. So finally, I said, hey, did you listen to the tape? He said, yeah. So what'd you think of it? He said, you got a pretty good memory. And that's all he said. See, that's how Bob was. I was still intellectualized in Alcoholics Anonymous. And he just beat me to the punch. And Bob could put it in such a simple way, he'd just beat you to the punch. I said, Bob, I'm really screwed up. He said, once you accept that, you'll be a lot happier here. But you won't have to act like it anymore. I was like, whoa. And for years, that kind of stuff went on. You know, and it changed my life. He made everything simple for me to understand. And the only thing that he ever peddled to me was Alcoholics Anonymous because he didn't know anything else. He said he had tried the church, he had tried every other means, and it had failed for him. So he was stuck in AA. He wasn't looking for another avenue out. He was only looking for an avenue in. And he taught me that. And he taught me how to work with other people. You know, he's the man that really taught me how to work. He said the number one enemy of working with other people is your people pleasing. You know? And he said, that's not what it's about. You know, it's not about people liking you. It's about helping people. It's not a popularity contest. It's about telling people the truth. Not in a mean way, but telling people the truth. They might interpret it as mean, but you're not trying to be mean. And I thought, yeah, that is in my way. I want to be liked. Now, I'm not really helping people. I'm feeding my own ego and trying to get somebody to like me. And he helped me to reverse that in my life. He introduced me to a God of my very understanding, along with, I think, some probably some pretty influential people in the fellowship as well. Because I still had some old ideas about that. I wasn't brought up in a religious home by any means, though I was introduced by that. I was introduced to that as a kid. And, you know, I bumped into Johnny one time. And Johnny told me, he says, "You know what I know about God after 30 years here?" I said, "What, Johnny?" He says, "It's not me." Wow. He said, "There's absolutely nothing here to figure out. There's only things to do. Intellectuals will try to figure out God's will and think that it is because they got something they wanted. A guy like you should be better left alone not to engage in that kind of intellectual stuff." Okay? I thought, okay. Because I'd heard all this stuff in fellowship, all these people all the time trying to figure out if they're supposed to move, get married, divorced. He said, "Just stay out of that." What I found through those folks' direction, what I found in the midst of it is I found a God that wasn't trying to hurt me. There was no redemption. There was no punishment. There was not trying to teach me a lesson, trying to get my attention by hurting me in any way, shape, or form. They introduced me to that. And you know what I found out? I can live with a God like that. They told me that the only thing that they know about God, that anything good that happens in their life, they thank that God for. And anything that happens in their life they don't like, they made a decision based on self that put them in a position, "You've got to become accountable here." And they helped me with accountability. That is my fault today. God, what a gift. Don't like it. Don't like it at all. But I know it. Yeah. That today it's my fault. It's not my parents' fault. It's not my grandmother's fault. It's not my sponsor's fault. Yeah. It's not the world's fault. If I'm in an unhappy position in my life, it's my fault. Well, about four and a half years ago, you know, life goes so quick you can't put the years together, you know. It could have been 3.5, but I think it's 4.5. I mean, my life just goes... I mean, we're moving. My wife and I decided that we were going to build a house, and so we did. We got the contractor, who's been a friend of mine for 20 years. And we had everything ready to go, and all of a sudden I got physically sick. Felt like somebody was pouring lighter fluid in my stomach and turning it on fire. Or pounding nails in the back of my shoulder blades while I was throwing up at the same time. And this was going on and off for about 6 or 8 months. And just an incredible amount of physical pain when it came. And a doctor told me that he thought it was food poisoning. So I thought it came from chicken. But it kept coming. I didn't eat any chicken. You know, the problem was, at that time, I was a vegan. I didn't eat dairy or meat. But I believe the doctor. Maybe it was on something else in the restaurant. So by May or June of that year, I found myself in a UVA hospital. Or actually, I think it was September, now that I think. So that had gone on for about 11 months. And just getting more physically sick all the time. So I ended up there and ended up in the emergency room, and I couldn't sit down because I was so sick, so I just leaned up against the wall and I said, "God help me." Because there's 40 people in front of me with their little cards and numbers on it. I had one eye open because the other one hurt so bad. So this nurse came up and she says, "You need help?" I said, "Ma'am, I am so physically sick, I can hardly stand here." So they took me in there. And I was in so much pain. And they hit me in the arm with something. And it was like, morphine, and it took the pain away. Now, I didn't get addicted to morphine, but I was glad that it was there that day. I was also glad that I had a meeting under my belt every day. I had active sponsorship in my life, and I was working with other people. But I was sure glad it was there that day, because it just relieved it. But I woke up hours later, they pulled out my gallbladder, and that was what the problem was. Got out of the hospital, The house had folded. The contractor had ripped us off for an awful lot of money. My wife wanted a separation because my attitude was less than noble in the house. Financial pressure puts an awful lot of pressure on some of us. And my company was getting sued for $2.5 million. So it looked like depression, didn't it? Yeah, felt like depression. In fact, if I had taken to somebody, I'd have had all the symptoms of it. I took it to an AA sponsor, and I took it to another man. And he reminded me I suffered from a spiritual illness, not an emotional illness, and I needed that. Because I was really, really emotionally in the ringer. I had every symptom of every diagnosis out there at that time. And I had a brewing anger on me and resentment that I hadn't had for years. And it didn't go away overnight. And I was going to get this contractor, and I was going to get him good. I talked to the Commonwealth attorney. I talked to the big attorney in Buckingham County. And I called this guy out there in Colorado. And I told him what was going on. I said, you know, if you're in my shoes, what would you do? And he said, there's only one thing left for you to do. And I said, well, what's that? He says, you're going to have to forgive him. See, that's why I need direction other than mine. I'm going for a lawsuit. This man said, no, you're going to have to forgive him. And it was kind of like Bob. Bob had gotten sick at this time. And it was the same kind of simple stuff. There it was again in my life. There was no long conversations to figure out anything. I was completely willing to accept direction. They knew that. I was not disagreeing with them, being defiant. They knew I was active in AA. And he said, you're going to have to forgive him. And we went through the resentment inventory, and that's where I needed to be. And we went through the fear inventory, and we went through conduct inventory highlighted by sex. Okay. And for the first time in my life, and I believe I was 15 years sober at that time, I actually understood the fourth step from page 64 to 71. I'm slow, aren't I? I actually had a four-step experience. I had done many four steps off of charts and sheets and all that stuff before. It worked to a certain extent. This just gave me more depth. And what happened in the resentment inventory is exactly what he told me on the phone, and it just kind of clicked. And the rest of it, I kind of saw, and I knew it was there, and I did it. But this one, it's like a magnifying glass, and it clicked. It said, we avoid retaliation argument. We don't treat sick people that way. I said, there it is. Wow, that's the start of forgiveness. We avoid retaliation argument. We don't treat sick people that way. And so when we were doing that, he said, what's a lawsuit? I said, it's retaliation argument. He said, we don't treat sick people that way. He says, you cannot afford to harbor this resentment. And by doing the lawsuit and taking that time, you're going to keep that resentment. And so I went down to Commonwealth. I dropped all of the charges. I asked God for help. I asked God for willingness. And I did that. I saw where I was hurt. This person hurt my self-esteem. Okay, embarrassed me. Took money. And I'd never been ripped off before. And it did. It shook me up. Okay? He had interfered with my ambitions of building my house and my marriage. Okay, so I was hurt. And I was interfered with. And he had threatened every instinct in me. Okay? And I saw it in black and white. And for the first time in my life, I saw what an ambition was. And there's nothing wrong with it. It's God-given. But it's not God-directed. It's self-directed. Okay? Ambition makes us do something in life. But it's certainly self-directed. And I was self-directed. And what Bill Wilson said later on in the 12-step, no matter how good you get in AA or how active you are here, he said all of us from time to time fall into two-stepping. Step 1 and step 12, we forget the other 10. And I thought, that's exactly what had happened to my life up to that point. I had become a two-stepper. Didn't even know what was going on. I couldn't have even shared it with you. Wasn't aware of it until the impact of the situation. And all of a sudden I saw, I've been a two-stepper for some time in Alcoholics Anonymous. Yeah. See, it's easy to rest on our laurels, and we all do. Yeah. But alcohol is a subtle foe. And I want to say, because of being active in AA, I never wanted to take a drink during that time. Now, I contemplated suicide on a couple of nights. Okay. but I did not want to take a drink of alcohol. I had been restored to sanity through the 12 steps fellowship and by the grace of God here. Never really entered my mind that I can think of. Okay. And these guys again laid out that I was not suffering from an emotional illness, yet it carried all the symptoms. I was suffering from a spiritual illness, and I'd have to move towards the solution, which was a power greater than myself, and how I would do that is through the steps, the fellowship, and active sponsorship. And there it was again, and that's what I did. Now, did that clear up overnight? No. It took me 2.5 years to come out of that emotional tangle. And after that, it still jumped up and down sometimes. I like this new thing in AA. It's like we're special if you have a mood swing. Oh, I got mood swings. You have mood swings? I got mood swings. We got something in common. You know, I got some mood swings. Yeah. They used to call it the roller coaster ride when I came in. And when you come out of something like that after 2.5 years, it's not like it all, you know, every day is ha, 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 ha. You swing back into that stuff. And much like our co-founder Bill, I would get scared about swinging back into that stuff because it just felt like crap. And it would come and it would come and then in shorter periods of time and then eventually it left. And I don't know if that was 3 years later. Okay. And at that time I said, you know, I'm physically sick. Kind of a couch potato in between the meetings and work and mowing the lawn. And I just asked God for some help. And everything in my life changed over a period of time again. I'm not saying I got struck by a bolt of lightning or anything, but I changed my diet. I changed everything. I started running up this hill. It was a 2-mile hill. And it would take me an hour. And I was dang to get up that hill. And I got up that hill. And I started doing more stuff and more stuff. And I changed my diet. I changed everything. And all of a sudden I started feeling physically better. What I had been suffering from after they took my gallbladder out is I was dehydrated all the time, even though I would drink at least a gallon of water every day. It didn't take the dehydration away. I was so physically sick that at 1 o'clock at work, I would have to throw up in the toilet, and all night long, I would just feel nauseated and drink Pepto-Bismol. I had massive headaches that looked just like migraine headaches, but the doctor told me it wasn't because my eyes didn't tear. But it felt just like migraines. They put me underneath the table. And I just said, God, I don't want to live this way anymore. I'm willing to do something. And I said, and whatever route people take, you take. I'm not up here to straighten anybody out. I said, I don't want to go through the hospitals and the doctors. Please give me something else. And I found it. And I found it in basic, simple solution again. And I'm like, wow. You know, I'll tell you, I got off a 26-mile mountain biking ride. And I'm like, I couldn't do it. I couldn't get off the couch. This is the thing about this God here in the fellowship. That anything, and I got to tell you, during that time, one of the favorite things in my life was 2 canisters of Copenhagen on a daily basis. I'm telling you, I did some Copenhagen. And I love smoking cigars and cigarettes. I got no problem with nicotine at all. I don't like to smell it today, mainly because when you get away from it for a while, it smells differently. But I had a love affair with nicotine for 15 years in AA. And one day, in that sickness, I said, God, would you please remove this desire of nicotine? I cannot do it by myself. I've tried for years and I failed. And I need a freebie from you, like the obsession to drink. I said, I just can't do it. I've tried. And it was gone. And I have not had a desire for nicotine for over 3.5, 4 years now. Gone. Plucked. When your source here becomes God in the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, 12 steps and trying to help another drunk to get what another drunk needs to do in their life done, if they're willing and not defiant, your life will take on changes that you will never, ever, ever experience without doing it. It will become a new and wonderful, brand new life to you. Okay? And everything that you were last year, you won't be this year. You will have rapid changes in your life. Okay? The problem with change for an alcoholic is it looks like it's a problem. Feels like it's a problem. It's got all the symptoms of a problem. And what does a guy like me do with problems? I avoid it. You know, I said in AA, say I'm willing to change, but I'm avoiding it at the same time because it looks like a problem. Yeah. Looks just like one. And I find today if I can embrace these problems that come to me in life through what I said, being active in the fellowship, the 12 steps, sponsorship, helping out other people, all of a sudden that problem has a solution to it. And we end up in a better place than we've ever been. The truth will set you free, but it'll piss you off first, all right, if you're like me. And what I bumped into through all this stuff and became very aware of in my life, been sitting in front of me for a long time, like I said, I'm slow, all right. I think how it goes in AA today is sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly, sometimes very slowly. And unfortunately, sometimes not at all for some folks. They just don't get it. Is what I found out for me, that AA stopped existing in my life as a living program. And I've been taught that almost since day one. AA was a living program. It teaches you how to live. And I'd hung on to that. It looked just like a living program. Felt like one. Had all the symptoms of a living program. And it served its purpose for a long time. But then I started to understand if I'm going to keep my chair here and not die drunk, which there is a possibility of anybody in this room tonight that's an alcoholic of dying drunk, any one of us. If I was going to keep my chair here, AA would have to stop being just a living program and it would have to turn into what I believe it was designed for as a giving program. Because I'd have to learn how to give effectively to other people. Or ineffectively, as long as I was giving. Okay? And all of a sudden, it just hit me. AA is a giving program. It's not just a living program. Wow. And I've centered on that old idea here for a long, long time. A long time. And it changed. And that's what happens in those times of strife and emotional upheavals. As things change in our life. And the change here in Alcoholics Anonymous for me has always been better. And the change prior to Alcoholics Anonymous had always been worse. So today I know what I suffer from. It looks just like an emotional problem. It feels just like an emotional problem. It has all the symptoms of the emotional problem. But I suffer from a spiritual problem that has a spiritual solution. And the spiritual solution is rested on me being active here. When I got married, Bob told me, and I was scared, I'd never been married before. I said, well, how do you do a marriage here? And he said, it's very simple. I said, how's that, Bob? He said, make sure that marriage never becomes your primary purpose or any relationship in your life. That your primary purpose is to stay sober and help another alcoholic to achieve sobriety. And I've been able to take that from my marriage to my work to every place in my life and make that the primary purpose. Have I been distracted from time to time? Yeah. Have I been distracted in my mind? More than I can count. But when it comes down to it, I know what my primary purpose is today. And when I live that primary purpose in my life, everything in my life gets better. Despite what I think, I feel, I believe, it all gets better. Because AA, there's absolutely nothing here to figure out. There's only things to do. Thank you.